I'm delighted to welcome back to the program Zaylee Pollan. She's an independent journalist. She covers New Mexico for Reuters and for other publications, and her master's work is on post-conflict reconstruction. She'll be talking about some of the work that she did in Cambodia this Sunday, the 29th of April, at 11 in the morning at the Travel Bug Book and Map Store. It's part of the Travel Bug's Journey Santa Fe series. Welcome, Zaylee.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here again.
So when you were in Cambodia, you were working with and talking to people who had survived the genocide that happened there in the early to mid-1970s. And although it's not yesterday, for many people, those are still fresh wounds. How did you find people? How did you get them to talk to you?
Well, this project was part of a Rotary World Peace Fellowship, and they basically gave me funds to go anywhere in the world to talk, well, really to do any project that I wanted. So it was an incredible opportunity. I chose Cambodia because the conflict was 30 years ago, and I was traveling with my then 3-year-old son. I wanted something that wasn't as fresh and violent. And I also wanted to look at the effects of trauma long after the event. I happened to come across in my research a psychotherapist who was speaking to the war tribunal that had just started in Cambodia. And part of his testimony was talking about trying to help people heal. This is a culture where people do not easily talk about anything. I found out later it was a culture where no one was actually asked to do any kind of real reconciliation. The idea of reconciliation there was, as the prime minister once famously said, dig a hole and bury the past and let's move forward. So I was really interested in looking at the work that this one psychologist was doing. And he was working with something called testimonial therapy.
Now, I understand that there aren't a lot of psychologists in Cambodia. That's not really part of the culture there. Is that correct?
Absolutely not. In fact, this one doctor was the first in the country, and he has set up a network that is revolutionary. I mean, it's really completely new, and the entire concept is new. And yet, when this tribunal started, the courts of Cambodia and witnesses started having all of these memories come up. This has been 30 years, and people that I ended up interviewing had never spoken of their experiences ever. So they're hearing testimonies being publicized. They're having extreme emotional reactions because they thought they would never have to deal with it again. And this one man is saying, you know what, it will help you heal if you can talk about this. I mean, this is something in our culture that is fairly common. I mean, talk therapy. But the way that you go through it in Cambodia is entirely different. It is an entirely different cultural process. In fact, the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder, which people here might argue the entire country is suffering from, doesn't exist there. They say what they're suffering from is something called baskbat, which is broken courage. So it was really interesting for me. I contacted this man. I said,
"Now, broken courage, just ha-
I okay.
Go on,
but okay.
Broken courage kind of sounds like post-traumatic stress. I mean, it's a different
Absolutely.
A different way of framing it, but
absolutely. But I think that the wording is completely crucial.
Yeah,
it is crucial because post-traumatic stress disorder is a Western construct, and it doesn't really mean anything to Cambodians the way they're presented. And I can talk either now or later about some of the questionnaires that are put out from American medical establishments that are kind of spread across the world. And this particular organization had to rework the questionnaire to make it appropriate for Cambodians.
Well, one of the things I learned from reading your article was that when Americans or Europeans or Westerners or whatever send out these kinds of questionnaires, it becomes what they call a kind of medical imperialism,
yes,
where they're asking other people to fit into a psychological framework that doesn't fit their own culture.
Exactly, exactly. And when they first used this kind of questionnaire on Cambodians, there was absolutely no indication of post-traumatic stress disorder because of the questions that they asked. But when they kind of transferred it and applied it to Cambodian culture, which is kind of similar a lot to traditional Chinese medicine, talking about wind attacks and coldness, seeing figures. There's one that was hysterical to me about, do you ever see this dark figure on the edge of your bed when you awaken? You can't move until the figure leaves, and then all of a sudden you can breathe again. And I said, this is actually common enough that you're including it on a questionnaire?
Right.
And they said, absolutely. And when we ask the right questions, the quote-unquote PTSD indicators are through the roof.
Amazing.
It is amazing. It is amazing. And it's I would assume that that would have to be different for so many different cultures, just in terms of the way they experience trauma, their own mental health, the way they heal, and the way they interact with each other.
So back to how you started this work on the ground in Cambodia.
Well, I had read this man's testimony, and I contacted him and asked if I could participate in his research, if I could help interview survivors of trauma and learn about this procedure called testimonial therapy, which is really helping people tell their testimonies, really focusing in on some of the most traumatic memories, and then creating kind of ceremonies to help them release that. And I think that's one of the main differences in some of these other cultures, which was happening in Cambodia, has also been practiced in India, that we don't really do here in America. We talk and then, you know, the ceremonial aspect isn't as much. He was eager for that to happen. And at the same time, because I've done kind of portrait and oral testimony before in Iraq, I invited a local photographer, Alan M. Thornton, to join me. So he flew out to Cambodia when we were there and took portraits of these individuals, which was yet another interesting project. But it was amazing. So they had these individuals, many of whom were participating in the court process or who had been rejected for very minor reasons. Perhaps there was a little indiscrepancy in their testimony and they had been rejected as witnesses. And this was profoundly huge for these people who had taken the step to want to join the court process and to want to testify. In this case, it was against Duk, who is the head of Toh Sling, one of the most notorious prisons there in Cambodia. So I was the one who would honor their story, basically.
That's a big job.
It's a huge job, and I don't think I had any idea going into it how big it was and how important it was. I said before, but again, how amazing it was to me, how many people had never spoken of their experiences before. This is more than 30 years after the fact, and we're talking to their wives, their children, their wives or their husbands who had perhaps been in similar circumstances, and people didn't exchange stories.
Now, one of the things we hear in the United States is stories about post-traumatic soldiers who come back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they may not talk about their experience, but they end up killing somebody or
yes.
brutalizing their girlfriend or trying to take their own life or taking their own life. Did you see manifestations like that there?
Cambodia is one of the most violent societies that I had ever witnessed. I remember first visiting the country in 95, and it was still very volatile. I was supposed to stay a couple weeks, and I remember after 2 days feeling like I had to leave. Now, even then, I didn't really know any historical context, but it was just a feeling that was exceptional. It has certainly gotten better, but in 2010, I was still overcome by the level of mistrust, the kind of paranoia, the kind of violent explosions that come out of otherwise beautiful, lovely, open people. They're so quick to anger. Even minor traffic incidents will go to people being beaten to death in the street. There were a number of incidents with Aiden riding in tuk-tuks where I had to cover his eyes because somebody was being beaten because they tapped a motorcycle. It was alarming. Even the dogs were. I was bitten by a dog, and I laughed and said to somebody, "Why are even your animals violent?" And the man said, "Because our people are violent, and they don't know how to get it out of their systems." The crimes against children were extraordinary, and they rationalized some of that by Buddhist theology, by saying, you know, well, maybe my son, my daughter was Khmer Rouge in a past life, and maybe this is what needed to happen. And I thought,
this is
incredible. Every single day, the violence against children, it was incredible.
We're talking to Zaylee Pollan about her work in post-conflict Cambodia. Now, did you have any sense of what it was like before the genocide? Was the society more peaceful and functional?
Yeah, I think it was a very different society, and mainly because it had a kind of social fabric. I certainly could never say that violence didn't occur. I mean, there was war, they had conflicts and alliances with Vietnam, and of course during the war. I mean, I think I told you right before we started interviewing, the Americans dropped more ordnance on Vietnam, they think, than all during World War II. they feel that Cambodia might be the most heavily bombed country in history. So a lot of this bombing, it's actually Americans.
All of World War II, including Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, Germany, everywhere.
People do not know what happened to Cambodia.
More than that happened in Cambodia.
Absolutely. These are new figures that are released. And there's an incredible center at your alma mater, Yale. Ben Kiernan runs DC CAM, which is a documentary center of Cambodia. And they've done really incredible work, really trying to look at the impacts of Cambodia and some of the targets and digging up all sorts of old documentation about what led to the war, what the people who survived, where a lot of the mass graves are. I mean, it's really because of their work that we know anything at all. So this is all new. This is 30 years after the fact. And I've been giving some presentations, and I've had people say, what were we doing there? We weren't supposed to be in Cambodia. And no, we weren't. So I think this is a part of our history that we really haven't reckoned with, nor have we reckoned with our responsibility, again, for sending the people of Cambodia into the arms of the Khmer Rouge. When Pol Pot first entered Phnom Penh in 1975, there were white flags, there was joy, there was this euphoria that finally the bombing was going to end, that the war was going to stop, and that suddenly there was going to be peace. And of course, the Khmer Rouge also played on that. But it must have been within 24 hours that the tune changed and that all of a sudden there was one of the most mass evacuations ever known. They cleared out the city of Phnom Penh within 48 hours. Everyone, and people thought, you know, for the sake of peace, for the sake of no more bombing, we're going to go along with this, of creating this agrarian society. People left without their belongings, thinking they'd be away for the weekend, a few days. And then suddenly things started changing. But it was one of these things where you don't know. The water is getting hotter and people don't know what to do. They don't want to go back to the bombing that they just experienced, but they don't quite know what's ahead. And so it was all kind of in the name of sacrificing for a better society, to the point where everyone is starving to death and they don't even have the energy to fight back. And they're saying, how did we do this?
Right.
And so this kind of, the way it happened kind of slowly, the paranoia developing until it kind of imploded, until even Khmer Rouge soldiers were turning on themselves. You know, Pol Pot himself became so incredibly paranoid that then everyone was an enemy. I mean, some of the testimonies and the personal stories I'm going to read, many are from Khmer Rouge soldiers. Maybe somebody who, you know, was caught stealing a coconut and is suddenly being accused of being CIA agent. I mean, the kind of accusations were so extraordinary, and the repercussions were deadly. So everybody started becoming paranoid. And one girl who was on a radio program in Cambodia, she was a child. Trying to tell some of these stories is incredibly emotional, and I'll try to get through it without breaking down. But this particular story was a grown woman who called this radio program that this one center put on every week, which was an incredible call-in program talking about people's trauma and what they may be experiencing. And she said that as a child, as a six-year-old little girl, she saw her parents take a coconut, and she thought that being a good citizen was to tell the soldiers. And the soldiers then killed her parents in front of her. And she's had to live with that trauma her entire life. And she's never been told that it wasn't her fault. And this is what so many of the people in Cambodia, I think, now have to deal with. This understanding that it's not their fault and that they were these kind of victims of this mass kind of psychosis that everyone bought into. Sorry.
Looking at what you're called to look at through the kind of work you've chosen is just a total setup for what that you call secondary trauma. So these people are traumatized. You, an empathetic human being, are not only studying this in order to let it be known for the rest of the world as a journalist and as a communicator that you are, but you have to go home at the end of the day, as does everybody who's working in helping professions in post-conflict situations, and deal with it enough so that you can go back the next day. How did you do that?
With great difficulty, and perhaps not with as much skill as I wish I had had I been more aware of the kind of self-care I needed there. This was by far one of the most difficult projects I have taken on, more so than interviewing men and women in Iraq who perhaps had just witnessed loss and destruction during war, U.S.-American soldiers in Iraq who were undergoing that every day, that kind of loss and trauma. And there was something about this, and I tried to write about it a little bit in this Santa Fe Reporter article, Journey to Cambodia. And it was also how restrained and calm the people were who I interviewed, who would talk about the most extraordinary experiences in this perfectly contained way. And I think for me there was part confusion about, as a listener, how to respond. I certainly didn't want to break down during interviews or to show more emotion than they showed, to kind of overcompensate or to take the attention away from them. So there was a lot of confusion there. But one, I was so incredibly grateful to have Alan with me, just a colleague, just someone to share that with. And then, of course, my son, who was just the most delightful, wonderful ball of love and light at the end of the day, teasing me because my Khmer was so bad. And
did you learn some Khmer?
I had a block with the Khmer language. I really could not learn it. And Aiden, even at 3 years old, would know more words and would remind me how to say please and thank you. And it was an incredibly difficult language, actually. Yeah. But, you know, for children, they're just such sponges. And he was in a Khmer Montessori while I was there. And so it was...
Two words I've never heard spoken together.
It was great. And it was actually run by a woman whose parents were killed during the Khmer regime and whose entire family was. She had escaped. She had been overseas when the Khmer Rouge took power, which is why many people did survive. If they were either away or were able to escape. And she came back with kind of Western notions, even Western notions of education. And it was very interesting speaking with her, having some kind of Western perspective and trying to deal with a Cambodian culture that is still wary of educating their young, even 30 years later.
Why is that?
Because they are afraid that the Khmer Rouge might come back. And anyone educated was killed. People who wore glasses were suspected of being educated and were killed and were taken for re-education. Of all the interviews and all the visits that I did, there was one house that had one book in it. And it happened that this man had been an attaché in the Congo, and he had brought back a book. That was the only book I saw. It was extraordinary. And there were very few people who would openly say, we're too afraid to educate our children. But a few would say that. They would say, this is the reason, and we're slowly changing. You know, young people are wanting to be educated, and they're wanting to come back and speak to their parents. And actually, part of the reason some of these people spoke to us had to do with the fact that their children wanted to know their experience. And what we were giving them was a written testimony that they could take back and they could share with their families and they could show their children. So that was incredibly powerful. And that was one of the ways that really helped me. I've kind of strayed from the question of secondary trauma. But it was also kind of looking at the higher purpose, looking at how much you are helping people who just have never had this opportunity and what they can share with their children and with their society. We ended up printing a book, a very limited edition book of all of the interviews and the testimonies. The testimonies are printed in English and in Khmer. And being able to give one to each of the people who interviewed and to other citizens that go to this transcultural psychosocial organization, which is the name in Phnom Penh, TPO, that they can share with other clients. And people started getting excited about it. We've, in fact, gotten requests. Are you going to apply for a grant? Are you going to come back? Are you going to do more interviews? And I feel like I am still recovering. It's a new world. You know, I'm a journalist, and I've studied a lot of psychology, but it's very powerful work listening to people's stories, and not just these powerful stories of trauma. I think you must know, you must have experiences where you listen to people, and people just want to share, and they want to share so much, and they have so many deep, sometimes incredibly painful experiences, and you have to be the conduit for that. some people do it better than others. But I think as kind of thinking, feeling, conscious people in the world, we find that that has purpose. And that by sharing that story with other people, it helps other people.
I think the one of the important things about this is that everyone who has suffered benefits by telling their story, and that there's a healing in telling your story. And why that is exactly, if you try to analyze it, is hard to understand, but it's the reality. I think it's why we have stories. I think it's why our lives are made up of narratives, and that...
Absolutely.
As W.S. Merwin said the other night, poetry preceded prose.
Beautiful. Well, and it's interesting that we use the term poetry also, because a lot of the thinking also is that psychologically, when we experience trauma, there's kind of this disjuncture that there isn't a fluidity. And by retelling it, we somehow put our own stories back together in a way that is consistent and that makes sense. And sometimes it may not even be a true story, but it is a valid story to us. And it creates a kind of, a continuity. Now, the other thing about telling stories and about making that a healing process, it isn't just in the telling, but it's also in the kind of situation that's created. I did a lot of my research and based a lot of my questioning around Judith Herman's incredible book around trauma and recovery, and how she says it's also about creating a really safe space. There are certain factors that you need to incur healing from testimony. And part of my research, I looked at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. I looked at a lot of the Gacaca courts in Rwanda that happened after the war there, or the genocide there. And why I don't actually feel that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission worked as a healing entity. I think it was not safe. I mean, the number of stories that I read about women who had to talk about their loss, about being raped, and instead of being embraced, instead of going back to a safe environment, they were thrown out of their communities. They were, one woman went back, she had people throwing rocks at her because she had been raped. And so this kind of rejection, this rejection because of the story, does not help healing whatsoever. So there have to be a number of elements in there,
right,
to create healing out of testimony. And what Cambodia did, and what some of the people who are practicing this kind of process of testimonial therapy, and this comes out of two people who were interviewing survivors in Chile after the Pinochet regime. They were just therapists who wanted to get historical account, and they started realizing that after talking to people, they really were experiencing a kind of healing process coming from it. So they termed it testimonial therapy. Now, when it was taken and practiced in other cultures in India, they decided to have this ceremony that I mentioned earlier. And in India, it was a reading in front of your community, to your family, to your friends, and a blessing. And in Cambodia, we did the same thing. After people had gone through this testimonial therapy where they spoke of it and they had their testimonies written down, we would go to the Wat, and we actually would go to the killing fields. I'm sure many people have seen movie The Killing Fields. It's about the only thing they've ever known about Cambodia. And it's an extraordinary place where you still walk the grounds and there are bits of bones and skin coming up from the ground.
To this day.
And when the storms come, more bones and more parts come up out of the ground. It's an incredibly powerful place. And there is a temple filled from bottom to top with skulls. And we would go in front of this temple and people... You would have an outside member, a member of TPO, that would stand up with the individual and would read their testimony to the community and to the Buddhist monks, and the Buddhist monks would bless them. This was an incredibly powerful process, and possibly one of the most important in this before family and community. It was that the Buddhist monks would bless them, because one of the other things that happened during the Pol Pot regime is that Buddhism wasn't allowed. Now, this was the balm, this was the savior, this was the community glue that held people together. And for many people that I interviewed, when I said, what would you need? What would you need from the government? What would you need to release the trauma of the loss of your parents? They said, I want money to go and to give alms to the Buddhists. I want to go pray for my ancestors. I want to be able to give in the name of my dead parents.
Imagine that.
And they couldn't do it. And I would ask people, you know, the translator, well, what would that mean? They'd say, it's about $2.50 for an offering. I said, and the government can't manage to do that for these people in terms of a form of reconciliation, in terms of really helping people heal? And he said, oh, no, we're afraid it would churn up too many bad emotions. So this is what they're living with here. So TPO offering this to this community was so incredible. And there was one man, I mean, everybody would really cry and sob and hold each other. And this is not something that's done in Cambodian society. And this is the one time when I would really see the show of emotion in society. And they would cry, and then they would be blessed. And then they would be like different human beings going home to their villages. They were brought in from villages all around Cambodia. And then they would be given a beautiful lunch. And they would go home with their written testimony, with a Buddhist blessing, and that was what they needed. You know, afterwards down the line, will they still have sleepless nights? Will they still have traumatic, you know, headaches and indigestion and all these other kind of indicators of stress? I don't know, but the immediate feedback is that it's incredibly helpful.
We're talking to journalist Zaylee Pollan. Do you have any information about how the Buddhist monks themselves survived? In other words, they were oppressed, killed, kicked out, whatever. And if any of those folks survived, they must have also had terrible trauma to deal with. Were they better equipped than civilians, so to speak?
You know, I don't know that. I know that so many were killed. I know that monasteries were taken over and used as prisons and torture centers, and there really was so little. They had to rebuild it from scratch. And the first times that monks came and did Buddhist ceremonies, it was so incredibly powerful. And they're still building up that community. So I don't know that part in particular. I think it would be really an interesting thing to look at. And there's so much more that needs to be done. I mean, after my article, I had somebody actually from the courts in Cambodia write me and say, this is really just the beginning, and you know, he appreciated that I kind of understood. I had seen it in a more realistic way. I guess many people have tried to kind of interpret people's experiences and have done it in ways that weren't really, I don't know, appropriate, good, yeah, accurate. So I appreciated that, and I think it is because in my work I really just try to have their words, and I just try to make it their story to the point that perhaps I'm not editing enough. They're really verbatim testimonies.
Well, I think there is, this also points out to me that there's something really to be said for the role of the empathetic, open-hearted journalist, because on the one hand you have to collect information and use your skills and use the criteria of your job, and on the other hand, the information doesn't flow unless you are there as an equal human being with those folks.
Absolutely. And I go back and forth too, though, with the cultural difficulties of that, and feeling sometimes, is this my work to do because I don't know this culture? And some of the challenges I had were just extraordinary, because of the way that people would tell stories, or they would use metaphor, they would come up with these incredible tales. And I've written in the reporter article that first there was someone who could speak English, that was hard enough, or could really translate directly, but then someone who could translate the metaphor and the meaning in it. How do we find that? How do I understand when someone says, and then it rained and I knew that I was going to be blessed, and what exactly did that mean there? And I can interpret it how I think it was, but sometimes I absolutely had no idea what they were talking about. And they would speak in these circular ways. They would start with the day they were born, and they would talk about the planting seasons, and I really felt like, wow, this is a challenge, an incredible challenge. And I would say to some people, would this be better if one of you were doing the interpretation? And on a number of occasions, they said, no, we wouldn't speak to Cambodians this way. I would never tell my story to another Cambodian.
Ah.
Because of the paranoia, because of this kind of fear, and because of the idea of speaking to an outsider, which sometimes is the case with being a journalist, right? That people will tell you things, like a bartender. People will tell you things they might not tell their spouse or their therapist.
Yeah.
Because there's something about that anonymity and that unknown that the other person carries. So I found that a lot, and I definitely found that in Cambodia. So while I struggled with my own lack of knowledge there and the kind of learning on the spot, and I certainly hope that I did do a lot of learning and could come to a place where I was as empathetic and open as I could be, it took me a while to get there. And I wanted that to be a gift to them, well, also for me, also learning about it. But there are other cultures that I would like to go to eventually. This is part of a bigger project that I really have been wanting to do around survivors of war. And my belief, whether false or not, I would love feedback on that, is really that in getting the human aspect and looking at really personal testimonies, that somehow we can relate to war in a way that we are not relating. You know, you look at, like, Rachel Maddow's new book, Drift. I mean, she talks about the way we can go to war so easily because we don't experience war. We send our people away from war, and then even when the soldiers come back, we're not sure we can listen to them. We don't have the appropriate support networks or medical facility to really accept them. We don't know war. We have absolutely no idea. So, yes, I will tell anyone who wants to come to this presentation on Sunday that it is graphic. I don't really recommend it for young kids. And it is somehow this way for me to say, is this some way we can understand the reality of what happens when we go to war? The way people actually suffer, the way they actually lose children and lose loved ones, and what they have to do to then deal with it.
So, you have witnessed all of this incredible trauma. And on the one hand, as we talked about earlier, there's, you don't want to get into medical imperialism, like, a term I'd never even heard until I read your article, but this idea that people coming in from the outside and telling them how they should do their healing process. On the other hand, what you also just said is they'll speak to people from the outside in a way that maybe they can't speak to their own because they're all in a traumatized society. Would it be beneficial in a post-conflict place like Cambodia to send in teams of foreign empathetic journalists and shrinks? I mean, what's the right thing to do? I mean, not that you know, but I mean, what's your perception?
And I don't really know. I mean, I think that encouraging people to tell their stories in a way that is appropriate, and just one note about the medical imperialism, that's also talking about a model of treatment. But the point is, people do suffer from traumatic experiences. There are impacts from trauma. We may not have the exact definition of them. So it's really, how do we approach it? And it's being culturally sensitive, and perhaps also sensitive to gender and how different people can express that. So maybe not sending in armies of Westerners, but maybe really encouraging them that this is a useful process by looking at books like this that we hand out to people and saying, these people really, it really helped them by having an organization like TPO there that is supported, that is given encouragement, that, I mean, there's so many people who are turned away, they can't talk to all the people who want to come now that it's out there.
So there is that need and there is that demand.
Absolutely.
For those services.
Absolutely. It's encouraging young people to get trained, to actually become counselors, to kind of learn about how it's impacting them. I mean, I not only want people to start looking at this work in Cambodia, but here in America and a lot of these Cambodian refugee communities. I mean, some of these communities in America, I mean, they had, again, post-traumatic stress disorder indicators up to like 78-87% of the population suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, an incredible thing, you know, not showering for weeks on end, being completely depressed, alcoholic, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, they were impacted. So how do we find a way to help people individually in the way that will serve them? Like I spoke about Africa, how do we find the way in African communities? There are very strong oral tradition there, so it's not as difficult. I compared it to Iraq, where people are so effusive and so emotional and so dramatic that I feel like it was much easier for them to speak about experiences than in Cambodia, where just culturally it's not part of that. So how do we introduce this in a way that's very sensitive and that helps people open and trust each other, but yes, also trust Western people. I think it was incredibly appropriate that I did it through TPO, with the people they recommended, with actually counselors on hand, with the individuals as I interviewed them, 7 hours at a time. There was only one occasion where I had to stop the interview, go outside and say, this woman is talking about committing suicide inside the court. Is she serious? Can you help me with this? How do we proceed? But I was really glad in all the other occasions that I did actually have someone there anyway. So that was incredibly useful. So yes, maybe Westerners could come, but really working within a model that they find useful and successful. And if I can, I just want to say one word about the courts, because it's such a challenge there. They don't have a war crime tribunal like in other countries where it's really run by UN and outsiders. Cambodia did not want that. So it is called the Extraordinary Chambers of the Courts of Cambodia, and it is part Cambodian and part UN at this point. And they're just obstructing left and right. Hun Sen, who is the prime minister, was former Khmer Rouge. So many people in power are, and they are trying to obstruct this process every step of the way. There is one man, Duk, the head of Toll Sling, who has been prosecuted, and there are five more that are now, there's going to be a trial and they're interviewing witnesses. But it is so difficult, and I think that really supporting this process, supporting a court process, is really the way that I think could help Cambodians a lot. And keeping the conversations open. We wanted to do a big public art display of individuals, and the government would allow it. There was one man who talked about incredible revenge fantasies, and I had to go back to him and say, are you sure it's okay that I publish this? He said, absolutely. I think directly after the war, there was all this kind of vigilante killing that happened. So now people may still have their revenge fantasies, but they're also trying to trust a court process. They're trying to say they are trying to find justice for us, but if they don't, I will still take matters into my own hands.
Celie Pollan is an independent journalist, and her master's work is on post-conflict reconstruction. She'll be talking about Cambodia and some of the stories that we have just heard at the Travel Bug here in Santa Fe this Sunday, the 29th of April, at 11 in the morning. It's part of the Travel Bug's Journey Santa Fe series. And you can go to the Travel Bug bookstore website, mapsofnewmexico.com, or go to journeysantafe.com to find out more information. Celie, thank you so much for telling us all these stories and being with us today.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. And I would love to make a call out to listeners here, because I'm really searching for ways to impact people and to educate people about war. I've chosen oral testimony, but I would love to hear, really, by email from people, how is it that you think is the best way to learn about war and about news? My email is zpollen@gmail.com, and I would love to compile some responses on my blog site if anyone would like to participate in that kind of conversation.
Z Pollen, and Pollen is spelled P-O-L-L-O-N, @gmail.com.
Exactly.
Thank you. I'd like now to welcome Terry Borst and Susan York. Terry Borst is professor of screenwriting at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and Susan York is an artist and professor of sculpture there. And we want to talk today about Outdoor Vision Fest 2012, which is happening this Friday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Outdoor Vision Fest is something that's been going on, what, last year was the first year?
Yes.
And what is it all about?
Well, it's really about, you know, if you think about how art is normally experienced, it tends to be in museums and galleries, it's indoors. Oftentimes it's kind of a sort of quiet, hushed kind of experience. This is an opportunity for our students to just show off all of their skills and creativity in a nighttime outdoor space. And all of the work that we're going to be seeing are environmental projections, video mapping of the architecture that's on campus, animations, live action work, and a lot of interactive media installations as well, and even kind of combinations of sculptural and video installations. You know, it's sort of like Disneyland, only, you know, creative in Santa Fe, in a way. And it's a really exciting one-night event that's free, it's open to the public, and a great opportunity to see just how cool and exciting and great that our students do in terms of the work that they do, just have a great time.
Now, part of the fun of this is the architecture of Ricardo Legarreta, who has built these wonderful buildings. I guess he died last year.
He died at the end of December, yes, in 2011.
And so these buildings are they're very colorful, but they are good places to project work onto.
And that's what makes Outdoor Vision Fest so interesting, because we've had the buildings at what was the College of Santa Fe and is now the Santa Fe University of Art and Design for almost 15 years. Legarreta won a design competition in 1995. And so these buildings are a part of us, and the students are making projections onto the outside of the buildings, every part of the building, the part of the buildings that maybe we've never really, really seen before, until these guys make these really specific projections that go on to them. So it's a collaboration really with the building and with Legarreta's vision that comes to life.
Now, are these your sculpture students who are doing this?
Yes, our sculpture students are making objects that will be projected onto, that some connect specifically to the building. But it's also students in graphic design, in filmmaking and animation. And there's probably a few others, too.
Oh, gosh. They really run all over the map. And I think that's one of the really exciting things about Outdoor Vision Fest is the interdisciplinary nature of the work that's being done. And indeed, I think part of the excitement is kind of this collision of the art, the film, the motion graphics with the architecture as well. And interestingly, one of the other things that we're having happening that night is we're having a visiting artist come from Istanbul Bilgi University, and he's been doing these groundbreaking installations that really kind of explore the intersection between architecture and just urban living, and then film and motion graphics and sound. And so they're going to bring a really exciting installation to this event that's going to be a homage as well to Ricardo Legarreta.
Will it also be projected onto the outside of the buildings?
Oh, absolutely. That's all of their work, what it is site-specific and outdoors. And previously, most of their work has been done in Istanbul, one of the great cities of the world. And it'll be exciting here in terms of their bringing, kind of this ultra-urban and just cutting-edge work to Santa Fe. And the installation will be happening at the tallest tower of the Visual Arts Center. With any luck, we'll be able to see it from St. Michael's and beyond as well. It's going to be quite something.
And Bilgi, where these artists are from, is a sister school to Santa Fe University.
Ah, very interesting.
It's one of several art and design schools within the Laureate education system.
I love how, it used to be when you think of an installation, you think of people putting objects inside of a big room. Now, something that's projected is a different, it's just a different kind of installation. It's a different way of thinking about what these words mean.
Yeah, I think, the fact that the technology is available now and affordable as well, and we're able to do, these really exciting things that couldn't be done literally 15, 20 years ago. A lot of this work, of course, is either in real time, computer generated, or else it's been pre-rendered on a computer and then is available in terms of our projection. So that's part of what makes this so new and exciting. Is you're exactly right. We've always been able to create artwork that's goes into these big rooms and that kind of thing. But now we can really exploit these outside and exterior spaces that we have.
And there is a sound component to it?
Many of the installations will be not only visual but audio in nature. And some of them where it's interactive as well. So as, people can do anything from, just clapping or making sounds, or the installation will react to movements as well that they're doing. There's one of the installations is kind of a graffiti spray painting, but it's not real paint. It's there. In other words, you're spraying, so to speak, in terms of a, sort of a mouse-like device there that you're aiming on a screen and cameras are picking it up and so on. So there's a lot of cool things like that. I think one of the really terrific aspects of the Outdoor Vision Fest is it's so family-friendly. Last year we had, kids there. They just love it. This is art that is its most accessible.
Yeah, and interactive.
And interactive, exactly.
Dane Chung is a graphic design teacher, and he he teaches motion graphics, and so that they actually write programs and decide what kind of interaction will happen within the space. So as Terry mentioned before, someone might clap and it'll shift an image in the room, any other kind of action. So it's really a cutting edge kind of work that he's doing with the students.
There's also a preview event on Wednesday, April 25th at 7 in the evening at Santa Fe Complex, which is now at 1807 2nd Street in that same area where Backroad Pizza is. And what's happening there?
Well, I'd say, in a way, it's kind of a sneak peek of some of the installations that will be happening at Outdoor Vision Fest that night. So we'll have several of our students doing very short presentations and short demos of some of their installations, but it's a great opportunity as well for media professionals and high-tech professionals here in Santa Fe and the surrounding communities to really kind of rub shoulders with our studios, with our students, discover what they're doing. And, of course, our students are going to be very soon moving into the workforce. We'd love to keep many of them here in New Mexico.
And that would be nice.
Yes, it would be nice. And, you know, it's a mixer of sorts. We might be able to think of it. They're a chance for professionals to network with students, find out some of the amazing stuff that they can do, the skill sets that they have, their ability to be able to execute projects there and think outside of the box. So, this is open to the public. It's free. If you'd like to find out, again, what the, you know, students at the university are doing here and just, you know, how the academic community can intersect with the professional community here, it's a great opportunity to come out and see all of that.
And it's a good reminder, I think, for all of us that art training is essentially professional training as opposed to something that you're doing because it's nice or pretty or fun.
Absolutely. We have students all over Santa Fe from Santa Fe University and the College of Santa Fe who have made their careers in every exhibition space and venue that we can think of.
When we think about how much that this community is driven by art in terms of its economy, but also then the intersection of technology that we have with Los Alamos nearby, Sandia Labs and Santa Fe Institute that we have. And I think what's terrific about the education that students get at Santa Fe University is, you know, it's more than simply, I mean, believe it, both of us are artists, we love making art, but a lot of it is about problem solving. And this is something that our students, as they move through the program, they're great problem solvers when they, you know, complete the program. And that's a benefit regardless of what direction that you head in life.
And I think it's kind of the place where science and art and engineering come together as you're looking at how to deal with certain problems. And there have been cases where when an artist gets in on helping to solve a science or engineering problem, the solution is both more elegant and more creative than it might have been otherwise.
Definitely.
Yeah. Terry Borst and Susan York are professors at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and the Outdoor Vision Fest 2012 is this coming Friday, the 27th of April, and it's late. I mean, it's after sundown, so it's 8:45 in the evening until 10:45, and you just basically go to the campus and look for the...
You'll see it. You'll look for the red Legareta buildings, and if you get there early, the BFA exhibition in the gallery opens from 5 to 7 p.m. and the BA exhibition is 5:30 to 7:30 in the Legareta building. So,
well, I want to thank you both so much for being here, and let's not forget about this special event preview at Santa Fe Complex 2 days before. That's Wednesday, tomorrow, and that is at 7 o'clock in the evening. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks a lot, Mary
Charlotte.
Thank you.